Blog Talk Radio.
His information for 1075 box 412 is as follows. Daycare center, two-story, 120x120 class 1. Approximately 50 children after school hours, senior citizens on the second floor.
South Haven 11th.
Engine 11.
We're still out here, a full still. We just had an explosion. We had an apartment that exploded. Traffic to channel 2. At 1030, advise.
103 zero. We're directing your location, Southend.
And Lilac.
Southend, we have working fire out here.
Big Piper and Lilac for engine 7, engine 4, engine 2, engine 1, 27, quit 1, rescue 1, fire 1.
Yeah, Battalion 1 to Main Emergency, give me a box. I'm going to set the station area truck on Lakeshore Drive. I'll give you the stairwells in a minute, office. We have a fire up there.
Main to 271, 271.
271.
We have report of three people on the roof in need of rescue.
Three people on the roof in need of rescue. Message received.
Welcome to this edition of Taking It to the Streets, on your street, in your city, across the country and around the world. Taking It to the Streets is a syndicated radio talk show on firefighternetcast.com, and I'm your host, Christopher Naum. As always, a heartfelt welcome to our dedicated and loyal program listeners and to our ever-expanding following of our newest live listeners and those downloading and listening to our program on their media devices. Taking It to the Streets is all about advancing firefighter safety and operational integrity for the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to the art and science of firefighting and, more importantly, the traditions of the fire service. The focus of Taking It to the Streets continues to be straightforward street-level talk with intelligent, stimulating, provocative insights and dynamic discussions and interactive dialogue, and most importantly, your listener participation. Today we have an exceptional program, and again, once again, I'm joined on this episode of Taking It to the Streets with my exceptional producer, John Mitchell, who's at the controls. And let's get right into the essence of our program. On this edition of Taking It to the Streets, we're addressing the most recent UL publication and studies that have come out on the residential attic fire mitigation tactics and exterior fire study. This recently was published by Underwriters Laboratory in conjunction with their Fire Safety Institute. And on this episode of Taking It to the Streets, I'm joined with Joe Pronesti and our good friend Doug Klein, as well as John Mitchell. So welcome, gentlemen.
Good evening, guys. Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good evening, Chris. It's great to be back on a show with you.
Absolutely. Looking forward, guys, to some good discussions. And in the background, I've got John. So, John, say hello to our listeners.
Hello to our listeners. I'm really excited about
very good,
show.
Very good, John. Thank you very much. You know, again, guys, you know, this is, and our listeners know this, you know, this is just like being around the kitchen table and or the day room, you know, over a cup of coffee at 2:30 in the morning after a good run. And, again, an outstanding program ahead of you here, just talking about some key issues. So our focus here on this edition of Taking It to the Streets is looking at some of the high-level overview of UL's study, which continues their phenomenal research and development and, again, provides an additional dot out there in the vast networking of research and data that provides further clarity of what we've been doing for decades in the streets in terms of our firefighting. So, again, we're talking about residential attic fire mitigation tactics and exterior fire. So with that, Joe, why don't you give us a little bit of insights on some of your direct participation at UL, and then lead us into some of our discussion here on this edition of Taking It to the Streets.
Sure. I'm Joe Pernesti. I'm with the City of Elyria, Ohio Fire Department, just west of Cleveland. I am a shift captain there. And as far as UL, I was lucky enough to be selected to be on a UL panel that studied ventilation and positive pressure ventilation. And everyone can look. We're probably going to wrap things up this year with it being released probably the end of this year, beginning of next year. One of the things that I found that in working there with Steve Kerber and the gang at UL is that, you know, they take this pretty seriously, obviously, and they do put a lot into it. And the number one goal is firefighter safety. And I don't think you'll find too many other places around or people around that are dedicated as Steve and UL as far as everything they do has our profession in mind. And I think when we start talking about this attic study, I think this is long overdue, and the fact that this is a typical fire for most America, and especially urban older communities that have these 2.5-story wood frame dwellings that have legacy construction, and the the open voids throughout that really can cause us problems with fire travel, and causes us, we have to do traditional ventilation methods a lot of times. And we found that, these fires are starting to occur, and they're injuring firefighters. They always have. But now we have some data and some science as to why this is happening. And I think that's exciting. I encourage everybody that hasn't participated or looked through the study and read the report that they do so. It's a good, great report. It doesn't take very long. And, I think it's worth everybody's time.
Doug, what's your take on some of the recent information that's come out through UL? Now, Doug has been involved with a number of NIST-related as well as UL-related activities. So, Doug, give us a little bit of insight on some of that level of involvement before we get into the actual discussion.
Well, I was fortunate enough to be involved heavily with the International Society of Fire Service Instructors. We began this journey with a lot of the research, working with NIST, and of course, UL is always involved with that. Because honestly, Dan and Steve do a lot of tag teaming, even though they're two separate agencies. They are very dynamic in how they share and how they work together. And, we started and we looked at building construction. All that started under Eddie Buchanan when he was the president of ISFSI. We were progressed up, and I had the good fortune to be, the president through both of the NIST studies in Spartanburg, South Carolina, where we found a tremendous amount of information and led into the passing of the torch to Steve Pegram, who's currently the president. And, we wrote the grant during that time period for what's going on with the modern principles of modern fire attack programs that are coming out, to where we pulled all of the research together and, put that out into a program that is being delivered across the United States, and it's really taking off. And it's amazing what a lot of folks don't know about the research that's been out there and what it's really telling us and what we're learning about heat flux, about, heat of rate, release rates, those type of things. When we start talking about the physics and the energy that goes along with some of these fires, and you can relate each one of these back to a variety of incidents where there were near misses, where there were line of duty deaths, and I kind of resonate with that stuff. So that's been my involvement, and I just got back from Maine doing the principles of modern fire attack for the society with the main instructors at an instructor program that they had, and we actually did a train the trainer so that, you know, the information can continue to be shared. So, you know, a lot of this, like you said, Chris, is stuff that we have validated. Joe said this. It's stuff that we can now, you know, validate and truly have science behind what we've been doing for a number of years and explain truly what's going on or what we have seen and make it make even more sense, you know, so that we have a safer fire service.
Absolutely. I'll give our listeners some insights, too, here. And again, to remind our listeners that we do have a number of direct links and narratives that are on our website to provide some clarity of our discussion points, and also to provide you with some of the direct links to much of the UL studies, and provide you with sort of a compilation of everything. So again, just to remind our listeners to go to firegroundleadership.com, which is on Penwell's Fire EMS blog network, which we are very appreciative of having the opportunity to showcase both our firegroundleadership.com program as well as the fireofficer.com website. So again, we do have a number of direct links that you can take a look at. One very interesting item here that will segue into our discussion here with UL study is that the U.S. Fire Administration issued one of their topical fire report series in January of 2011. And some of the key findings when we talk about attic fires within the residential buildings is as follows. There are an estimated 10,000 residential building attic fires that are reported nationally, according to the U.S. Fire Administration, each year, which result in an estimation of 30 deaths and 125 injuries, as well as over $477 million in property loss. And again, the residential building attic fires are considered part of the residential fire problem and comprise approximately 2% of all residential building fires. And again, almost all of the residential building attic fires are non-confined fires, and that equates to 99% of those statistics. One in two family residential buildings account for 90% of those residential attic fires. And again, the majority of those conditions within the attic space, within that compartment, do extend beyond the attic compartment. So certainly when we talk about the challenges of attic fires as they relate to both legacy as well as newer modern residential construction, but particularly in the legacy construction in our typical 1.5 and 2.5 story wood frames and our deckers and such, the continuing challenge when we talk about attic fires is this, and I'll open it up to questions based upon this. Attic fires pose most of our hazards for the fire service, and typically when we do have a fire occurring in the attic space, typically it goes unnoticed until it becomes self-revealing. So we may have a very progressive fire that's developing, certainly impacting and growing based upon the fire load package that may be present, which, again, in that storage area, within the concealed spaces of knee walls or other configurations in these areas, it may require or it may result in a longer burn time before it becomes self-revealing and becomes detected, which, again, creates another layer of risk and danger to both our firefighters as well as the residents. And, again, the other element here that we'll segue into the UL study is that we are talking about the fire involvement both in terms of insulation, structural elements, and wood. And again, basically, specifically when we talk about legacy construction, there are some very unique factors based upon the predictability of performance of those older type structures based upon their vintage. Again, normally, again, pre-1960s into the 40s and 30s. But also, more importantly, and again, our listeners are very much aware of this, is that due to the fire load packages that we have today, we significantly increase the heat release rate, and now we have ingredients for disasters all the way around. So this was certainly a very timely study based upon its conception and through the last couple of years of its continued development and obviously the issuance of the report. But I will also make our listeners aware of, again, some very prominent incidents that have occurred throughout the United States, the most recent ones in Chicago. But again, we go back to the Kyle Wilson line of duty death in Prince Williams County, Virginia, and certainly we'll touch upon a fire which resulted in a quadruple, a four line of duty death in Syracuse, New York in April 9th of 1978 that resulted in a concealed attic fire which resulted in four line of duty deaths. So with that, Joe, give us a little insights specifically to UL's online computer-based training module, and how is that? Again, there's obviously a lot out there when we talk about the research, and the research is voluminous in nature, but the key to all of what UL has done, continuing in the tradition and the consistency of all of their past and previous research projects, is that they have summarized and developed a web-based training program that really is the key element here for all of our listeners as well as the fire service. So why don't you run through some of the key elements there?
Sure. Probably one of the biggest things that they've done is, you know, they've made it very firefighter-friendly. They divided down to two different sections, and one section, it will go over all the experiments that they did. In this particular study, they were in Milwaukee, and they show you in the first level, you can choose which one you want. One is a two-hour course, one is a one-hour course. But if you choose the two-hour course, which I encourage everybody to do so, they will actually show you a video of each type of test that they've done, whether they had ventilation, vertical vent, fire. They did one study where, you know, they had a fire outside the structure that got into the attic, and they applied water on the outside first, sweeping the eaves. They had temperature sensors. So they go through all that. The other one-hour class is more tactical considerations, to where they've taken everything, grouped it all together, and they package it up into 60 minutes of what you need to know in the street in the middle of the night, and what you're as you're facing a house fire, an attic fire. So that part, and if you know one, if you haven't seen any of these UL online, they're basically a PowerPoint that is has voice. You push play, and it runs you through the entire thing. You don't have to do anything else. You have to advance the slides, but they have them on basement fires. Again, this attic fire study, building construction, it's great. And I believe you have the links to it on the site, Chris, but it goes into it handles everything that you need as far as what you need to know and the basis behind their study, their data, on why they came to their conclusions, which is so important because there's so much out there, people teaching and on the internet, Facebook, that we'll just do it this way. And this explains the data. It gives you the proof of why these things are so important.
And that's a key item. You know, we talk about much of the direction that the fire service has taken, and all of us have discussed this in the various conferences nationally and regionally, and certainly on many of the radio programs, certainly in the last 12 to 18 months. And again, the whole aspect of research and taking that research to the street, you know, much of what is being presented tactically is, in many instances, is nothing new to many progressive departments around the country. In other words, and we were talking about this offline amongst the three of us to our listeners, is that tactically when we talk about, you know, sweeping the eaves, and we talk about introducing a stream from the yard within the compartment setting, it goes well beyond the transitional attack element. And again, knowing and understanding building construction as it's characteristic to the vintage and age of these types of buildings and the manner in which they are constructed with raftered conditions and knee walls and the compartmentation, there's a whole different set of parameters in which the buildings are going to not only perform but also become affected by the impact or impingement of fire and fire growth. So there's many layers here, but certainly tactically, it's not always about going inside. It should be a combination of a number of factors to achieve the goal of allowing us to be the most efficient to achieve the tactical objectives, which includes, again, life safety of the civilians and obviously the ability to minimize and mitigate that fire. But the empirical information, the reasons why, and Joe, you said it greatly here, you know, it gives us the rationale behind what the results are indicating. And that is so, so important to our listeners to understand, at least in concept, maybe not so much in the level of detail from an engineering perspective, but understand in concept the rationale behind what was being assumed in terms of the study, in terms of an experiment, you know, what the parameters of that experiment were attempting to identify visually and then to be able to quantify through the various means of assessment, and then to be able to give us some reasons why things were happening. Why did fire travel a certain way? Why did the host stream give us the capabilities of doing something positive or negative? So, you know, we take a look at that part of it. So, you know, Doug, let me ask you this. When we talk about fire ground operations, and again, you know, we go back to old school tactics that all three of us have certainly cut our teeth on in our younger days, but legacy construction, and especially when we draw our listeners back to, you know, the specific module of Module 5 within the CBT, which talks about the tactical considerations. You know, give us some of your insights on what you saw through the residential attic and exterior fire presentation, its relationship back to the tactics, and what are some of your insights from a commander and a company officer perspective?
Well, a couple of things that I can relate back to is actually, you know, from being on the streets and actually performing, you know, from the firefighter level up through command level, what we're seeing is legacy versus modern construction have a lot of differences, but yet they're very, very similar in a couple of components that we have to think about. First of all, everybody talks about modern construction having, you know, a lot of open void spaces. Well, they do. But we're also seeing that a lot of this modern construction has some cut-up designs by the way that they're actually building the buildings. So even getting a hose line up into the attic area, in some cases, because of the way the roof systems are engineered or built, is still very, very difficult. If you've got, like, you know, we see in the studies with UL, if you got a good ranch like that and it's modern, you can probably knock down the, you know, the vinyl that's going to be in the soffit area, and it's real quick. The problem that I have seen and actually witnessed is that there's still a lot of areas up there that they're putting up sheetrock. They're making those storage areas for quick access attics. We're seeing a lot of attic spaces that are knee walls in modern construction. Well, in the legacy construction, we saw that, you know, in these areas, because there were additions added to homes and some of the roof systems were, you know, redesigned and added on to, you still have the void spaces, but you can't always get to them. This is where it becomes very, very critical at a tactical level. And there's nothing that can be, and I talked about this even over the weekend, how important it is for you as companies and you as organizations, if you're in a single house volunteer department to, you know, you got 40, 50 stations and you're riding a district, you have to know exactly what these buildings really look like. And the best way to look at modern construction is watch them when they're building them. And make those notes, make those mental notes, make those pre-plans, make those what I call neighborhood pre-incident surveys that can be shared, because you may not be at that station for a period of time. There may be somebody that's filling in for you, and then being able to recognize that. One of the other pieces I think we've got to do in pre-planning is and this is the preparation from when you're going to run these calls, is we run a lot of med calls. Take an opportunity to really look around, and you can start, you know, seeing design features inside homes that are going to tell you what you need to do. What we are seeing is that the tactics that we've used, and, you know, we've either got to get a hose line into that area somehow with water stream application, whether you can get it from running, you know, along the ridge line with, you know, coming through the eaves, a side gable vent or an end gable vent, whether you're, you know, going up through the soffits, whether you're actually using an attic access, you've got to get hose lines in the area. One of the things that in some of these bigger buildings is you have sheetrock or something's been changed, and there's a small area where fire can progress into from one compartment to the other, but it's hard to get hose lines and streams directed in there, and even the steam conversion, because of the flow paths, are not allowing, you know, the progression of the steam back to the seat of the fire because of how the flow path is actually working. A lot of times it's a unidirectional flow path where it's one way and it's exhausting. So we have to think about that. We have to really get involved with, you know, tactically getting the size up and understanding what we're looking at. And even, you know, you got to go as far as you got to get out of the stations. You got to get out on training nights and really begin looking at some of this stuff and practicing. The key is knowing what's going to work from the studies and also by what you've experienced in the past. I've done every single one of these, and they all work on the specific types of construction and the design features of, you know, buildings. You have to look at that.
Bingo. That's what I was going to elaborate on a little bit, is that you have to know, I think, the era of your community, when it was built, because the one thing that the biggest thing in my area or in a lot of areas that are older is that these attics are their living areas, and you won't find that so much on the newer modern construction with the trusses, that it's just a wide open space. But in older homes, you could have a living area, and when a new firefighter comes on or you're a newly promoted officer, can you tell going on into your district how old the era of the house that was built is? Do you think that it's occupied, that attic area is occupied? How can you tell? What are the signs that it might be occupied? The voids are going to be, you know, with the knee walls. And I think the other thing that is important too is that these houses that are 100 years old, 50 years old, whatever, that nowadays it is so easy to go to a store, purchase products, drywall, whatever, and finish off an attic for added space, for bedrooms, for offices, whatever. And that house may not have been built with a finished attic, but over 50, 60, 100 years, you got living, you know, living quarters up there. How can you tell? And what does that do to the fire? And the, you know, now you have a small, narrow area with very limited ventilation points that you could have people in, or you know, fire travel. How do you get up there? The other thing that I'd really like to point out is one of my biggest pet peeves is standing in front of a house that's burning or being inside, and crews are searching for attic access. If you're inside and conditions dictate that you can operate inside safely, we cannot spend a lot of time trying to search for an attic access. You got to learn to make your own. And I find that one thing alone, just those few minutes of searching, has burned down a lot of houses, at least where I'm from. That time it takes, oh, we can't find an opening, we can't find an access, make your own.
Oh, I couldn't
agree. That's a good point.
You know, more. I mean, that's definitely, you know, part of the things that we've run into. And, you know, even, you know, going in some of these bigger homes, and especially if, you know, you're going to the second level and it's got an attic above it or a potential attic above it, is just, you know, popping a hole so that you can see what's above your head. Good example of this, and you know, everybody gets so hung up, and this is one of my pet peeves. And, Joe, I know that you're in an area where, you know, it's kind of like my area. There's so much you know, that goes from one end of the spectrum to the other. But we have to stop and think, this is not just about residential buildings, you know, of single-family homes. We have to, you know, begin looking at this, especially in our commercial buildings, with apartment complexes. And this tactic and all these tactics that we have and we've talked about, you know, thus far, and the studies and the relationships to it exist in these multifamily residential buildings. And, you know, a good case that I go back to is when I was in Chapel Hill, I pulled in second due laying in to a good friend of mine, Barry McLam, and he was standing in front of the building. And, I mean, we had a huge apartment complex on fire, and it was like, you know, what do you need? And he said, give me a minute. I'm thinking. I said, well, I'm going towards that firewall and try to cut it off so it don't burn past the firewall. And people don't think that you can burn past the firewall. You can.
Right.
When we walked into the apartment, it was just as clear. I turned the lights on. They worked. So it popped me a hole in the ceiling. And when they, you know, made a hole in the ceiling, you could look up, and it was nothing but orange. And we were like six apartments down from where the fire was venting. So you got to be quick. You got to make your own hole. And, I mean, we started flowing water there. We opened up a place and began flowing water, called for a second hose line into there, and then a third being a 2.5, you know, so that we could try to stop the progression of fire and hold it in that attic area, even though we had apartments on the second floor on fire. So, you know, these tactics, whether you're below, whether you're outside, whether you're using the gable ends, you can't wait. Joe hit it on the head. You've got to move and make something happen because, you know, Chief Brunicini says it best. The best water is fast water. Get it on the fire.
And that's, but you know, guys, where, you know, we talk about knowing our buildings, and Joe, you know, it's certainly in any realm, it's unacceptable for any company not to have a fundamental understanding of their buildings within their, certainly in their first due, regardless of what the age may be. If you don't know your district and don't know the vintage and characteristics of your buildings, as well as a level of understanding of access, egress, and movement points, both horizontally as well as vertically, then again, I would say that you're derelict. You know, you're just, the company officer is not doing his job, and the company itself is not doing its job in terms of understanding the traits of what is so important. We talk about structural firefighting in the built environment, and that is something that all of us have constantly promoted and advocated out there. So, again, let's before we take a break here, let's bring it back to center when we talk about legacy constructions and those attic fires. And certainly one commonality that we will leave our listeners with before we go to a break here is that these are, again, commonly ventilated limited fire conditions. There are either open compartment conditions in which we have an open space from end to end within that compartment. And, again, some type of a predominant pitch to that roof. We have a structural system that commonly in our legacy construction is a raftered roof construction that has a sizable amount of deck sheeting material, which may be a variety of construction elements that is exposed. So that increase in surface area as well as the exposure of the structural elements, again, is a key factor when we talk about attic fires. Then we add the other levels of compartmentation specific to knee walls that, again, the UL study specifically points out due to some line-of-duty death issues and near-miss events. So we'll take a look at and discuss a little bit further a couple of factors. We'll talk a little bit about the application of water, both exterior, and then also talk a little bit about the importance of coordinated ventilation as well as the water application after we take a brief commercial break. So, John, take us to commercial, and we'll be right back.
Yeah, we will be right back. A reminder to our listeners, give us a call. Join in on the discussion tonight on attic fires, 347-884-8198. Again, 347-884-8198. We'll be right back.
You know that buildingsonfire.com has a vast series of exceptional e-media offerings that include FireGroundLeadership.com, TheFireOfficer.com, Buildings on Fire on Facebook, as well as Twitter. Check out these premier websites. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter and get engaged to meet the operational demands of today's evolving fire service, integrating the art and science of firefighting for operational excellence and firefighter safety.
Life is complicated, but your education shouldn't be. At Columbia Southern University, we'll make sure of it.
We offer quality online programs, low-cost tuition, textbooks at no cost, and caring faculty and staff to help ease the transition of going back to school. We'll be here to support you every step of the way, from application to graduation.
We also offer financial savings through our scholarship opportunities and learning partnership programs.
Your success is our success.
So join the CSU family, and together we can achieve your dreams.
Hi, this is Tiger Schmittendorf, Chief Storyteller at RunToTheCurb.com, inviting you to listen in to Firefighter Storytellers on the Firefighter Netcast Radio Network. Run to the Curb, tell your story.
Taking It to the Streets is all about advancing firefighter safety and operational integrity for the fire service through provocative insights and dynamic discussions dedicated to both the art and science of firefighting and the traditions of the fire service. The focus at Taking It to the Street continues to be straightforward, street-level talk with intelligent, stimulating, and provocative insights and dynamic discussion with interactive dialogue and, most importantly, listener participation. Just like around the kitchen table or in the day room over a cup of coffee at 0230 after a good run. And now, the latest edition of Taking It to the Streets with your host, Christopher Nall.
Welcome back to our second segment of Taking It to the Streets. And again, we're talking about residential attic fire mitigation tactics and exterior fire, which is part of UL's most recent publication of their testing data and their most recent study. So again, I'm joined by my esteemed colleagues, Joe Pernesti and Doug Klein, along with John Mitchell. And we talked a little about in our first segment, sort of laying the groundwork out about legacy construction, the issues affecting both the building, the compartment, and some of the elements of firefighting, both historically as well as currently, and again, some of the factors regarding the compartmentation, fire spread, and the risks to firefighters. We ended our first segment with a little bit of a discussion about the attic fire conditions, in which, again, we have commonly a ventilation-limited condition. Talked about the importance, or started segueing toward ventilation, the coordination of that, and water application. And I did make mention of one feature that's very common within the confines of a raftered structure, residential structure with raftered construction, again, of legacy construction and the vintage of the 40s and 50s from that standpoint, and that dealt with knee walls. So, Joe, why don't you give us a little bit of a description and definition and some examples of the knee wall elements and how that is a significant priority. Now, within the learning objectives, again, within the UL CBT, there's quite a bit of importance posed both to knee walls and some examples that go back to a recent line of duty death in Chicago.
Sure. I guess the best way to describe it for our younger listeners or newly new members of our service is a knee wall basically will square off an attic space to where the walls, it'll square off typical, picture a typical house with, we'll talk geometry here real quick, looks like a triangle. Well, what will happen is if you want to create any kind of living area or put up some walls, you'll square off that area. And it is basically putting a square inside a triangle, and the outsides will of that that perimeter will create a void. And in that void, fire can travel very easily. Also in these voids, there'll be pipes or a pipe chase. So it is a void that basically will run along the Bravo and delta sides of the structure, down low at the bottom part of the triangle of the house as you're looking at it, and that can cause, again, a hidden pocket of fire. And what is so dangerous about these knee walls and these hidden voids is you open up without water, or you open up and ventilation is not timed, and that fire just comes right out at you and you're not prepared. And that has injured a lot of firefighters. A good example of this that I've even have had problems with in my career is you go up the go up the stairs to the attic, a large attic on the Charlie side. You go to the A side to open a window. While you're going to open up that window, someone opens up the knee wall or opens up the wall in the attic, and now you're caught between your exit and there's fire in between you. You're cut off to your exit by fire because they've opened up the knee walls and you don't have the fire suppressed. So that's kind of a layman's term of a brief description of a knee wall. And again, in the UL study, they talked about attacking the fire correctly with knee walls in mind, and to maybe open up on the second floor around the perimeter of the house on those walls that you can access the knee walls and get water in from below. There's many different ways to get in there, but this UL study really has put a focus, and rightfully so, on knee walls and the voids that can kill you, and have definitely played a role in some line-of-duty deaths. And probably the most notable one recently was the line-of-duty death in Chicago.
Yeah, you're making reference to the November 2012 line-of-duty death. And again, we're referencing back to the tragic loss of Chicago Captain Herbert Johnson, who was operating at a residential 2.5-story wood frame structure. And again, for our listeners who aren't aware of it, this residential setting was a typical 2.5-story wood frame, type 5 construction. It was approximately about 120 years of age, built around 1896. And it was approximately 2,000 square foot. So, again, we talk about the relationship of a modern 2,000 square foot residential, and we talk about the 2,000 square foot legacy constructed residential, and again, some of the unique characteristics from a construction standpoint. Now, one of the important elements, now, and again, our listeners should take a look at the NIOSH report that was issued, as well as the fire dynamics simulations that was recently published within the last couple of months, that provides some very unique insights on the fire dynamics and the fire travel within the compartment and how they affected this typical common level of operation that many of us experience day in and day out, but how the gravity of that of those fire dynamics coupled with the building's characteristics and the conditions within that attic space led to certainly a very tragic outcome. But these are the lessons and the learnings that we have to constantly focus in upon. And again, our researchers, our engineers at UL, at NIST, and certainly at NIOSH collectively put together the various layers to give us information to improve our fireground operations and be better at our trade when we talk about those elements. And again, we did have on our website, actually on our older website, commandsafety.com, for those that want to do some further research. Again, if you go back to the November 2012 time frame and do a quick Google search, we did provide some initial insights as that incident was unfolding within the few days of the event. But as Joe just described, we also do have some very good graphics courtesy of our buildingsonfire.com website that provides some graphics that'll give you some better indication of construction features of a raftered, common gabled raftered framing system, and exposed knee walls that are not framed in. So these are the exposed framing systems and the manner in which those concealed knee walls and voids contribute. Now, and I'll pose this question out to either Joe or to Doug, but when we talk about the collar beams and the vertical framing, you know, Joe, you made mention about how these compartments can get framed in with our gypsum wallboard. We really haven't even touched upon or started talking about the level of insulating quality that may have been added to these older buildings, because typically most of the legacy construction did not have any form of insulation in the days and eras in which they were built. So a lot of the retrofits that we are seeing, so now we have all of our aged sheathing material that's present that is in the flow path within the channels of the rafters and the eave lines and the vertical voids of the walls on all sides of the perimeters, and then the collar beam, which is a critical element here. So I've seen firsthand some of the things that in which those collar beams have been removed, because again, the collar beam provides a critical structural support piece to keep the rafters in place. But again, the absence of the collar beam, because of renovations, may create an unstable condition in which that roof may, again, have imposed loads and other factors. But it's very common to have a knee wall that comes up and then suddenly peaks off into the upper ridge line. Or if the collar beam is present, you will have a continuation of a flat ceiling area up there. Any experiences from your standpoint in terms of some fire grounds, either Joe or Doug, from that standpoint with the collar beams and the knee walls?
Well, as far as the collar beam, just wanted to add that basically it's a horizontal member between the two rafters or between two rafters. And I have seen it to where, you know, again, that they'll frame them out and you'll have that space that when you finish off an attic, you'll have that space above the collar beam to basically the ridge that you have another void. They keep the rafters from sagging. Now, if you remove that collar beam, which I would imagine can be done to add room, you've just basically have taken away, it's like a truss, a modern day truss, where you have lessened the strength of that roof under fire conditions if you remove that tie. You'll see it. I think everybody here that has been up into an unfinished attic has seen a collar beam, maybe did not know the exact name of what it is, but it is a very important piece of an older roof framing.
Part of what I've seen, Chris, is even in the modern construction where they're trying to build houses that look old, so to speak,
mm-hmm.
One comes to mind that we had that we were riding into, and I was riding the truck company at that point in time, and they sent us, you know, to the second floor as the first, you know, truck that was arriving because to assist in, you know, do some opening up and to do some search real quick. Well, one of the things that we found is when we get in there, we didn't realize this had knee walls in it because it didn't even appear that way. And I know Joe's talked about the appearance of what it looks like in some of these attics. And this was a modern construction. I mean, it was built probably in the late 90s. And we got upstairs and we were, you know, engaged in some firefighting. We had done, you know, the typical ventilation based on what we would normally see or consider in this. And this was really one of those houses that was built different than everything else in there, but it looked the same. And that's one of those key pieces I go back to. If you get the chance inside of a building to look, you need to take that chance and look. Spend a little time. But we got on the second floor of this building, and it was actually a cathedral ceiling from downstairs up. You had like the one section or half of the house on the second level had like bedrooms and offices and such. And we got in there, and it began to, you know, get fairly extremely hot. And we're flowing water. We're working. I mean, these are experienced guys. I mean, these are guys that have been on multiple jobs, so they knew what they were doing. They had all that, you know, down pat. And, you know, I kind of turn around and look, and I see, you know, carpet lighting off behind us. I was like, oh, wait a minute, you know, we need to reevaluate here. And we went through this, and we found that the knee walls were actually done in such a manner that you couldn't see them or know that they were there the way they redesigned or the way this area was built. Well, guess what they put in that storage area or the knee wall area? An attic space with everything you could possibly think of. One of the keys is they're maximizing in even old and new construction, because I had these knee walls that were built in the home that I grew up in, you know, back in West Virginia. And we had attic spaces on either side. And it was crammed full of stuff like you would not believe. And
yeah,
that's really very, very common.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I don't know how it got, you know, crammed in, you know, like that. But in this modern, and I mean, these were like 3.5 foot areas, 4 foot areas. There was so much stuff. Ryan Pennington would say we had Colliard Mansion, you know, conditions in those knee wall attic areas. So can you imagine the fuel loading and what was going on? You know, doing the post-incident analysis and, you know, looking at that, because we backed down the steps, you know, deemed the area untenable, regrouped. We did several different things, and, you know, we can make conditions good for just a little bit, but it would go away, even with vertical ventilation. And what was happening is we were getting overrun by the amount of energy that was being produced in a convection oven area. And that's exactly what it turns out to be in a lot of these cases. And you've got to get them opened up. And, you know, Joe was talking about getting, you know, water into these areas, and you were talking about getting water into these areas quick. You got to recognize it, whether it's internal or external, and make sure that, you know, we don't have fire. So, again, that's just an experience that, you know, fortunately, you know, we had great fire ground officers and firefighters that recognized, you know, very quickly as conditions were not, you know, changing, that we had to, you know, reevaluate our tactics. And, you know, we basically deemed it was untenable and backed out and redid some work and changed some things and did a little more investigation, quick investigation, and decided, you know, at one point that, you know, we're going to let this thing go. We cannot fight what's in there. We don't know what we're up against or something. And in fact, we actually considered a natural gas leak at one point in time, even with it shut off, that there was some alternative feed going into the building that we could not control, that we could not find. And that,
but, you know,
we might have a natural
isn't that, you know, everything that we've just described through our thread of conversation all goes back to fundamentals of understanding the building, understanding the potential for characteristics within a given space. So in this particular discussion on this show, we've been talking about the compartment being the attic space. And there are very predictable characteristics, predictable construction features, predictable variations of the compartment. We can have a large open compartment within the attic space from gable to gable, from end to end. We can have concealed conditions that provide for either partial or full enclosures that end up resulting within the, we could have an occupiable space, we could have a storage space. But again, if we have knee walls that are present, you may have three other spaces, one on each side of the eave on both the Bravo and the Delta sides, and certainly the conditions as we described above the collar beam that, again, create another concealed space going up to the ridge beam along the entire length of that roof. And again, and that's just talking about a straight gabled type of roof, which typically are going to have a one-on-one ratio in terms of their pitches. So we can have a combination of sizes. We can have a combination of volume spaces based upon where the knee wall vertical strut is located, how far close or away from the Eve lines it may be. And Doug, you just gave a great example, and I certainly can think of a number of incidences over my career in which we had actual doorways. Small doorways, you know, within the knee wall, and that's what constitutes a knee wall, that they are not a full height wall, but have some level. And again, the older, very older homes typically were at knee height. But nonetheless, you will typically find, and I want to encourage our listeners, as they have these opportunities to present themselves, and again, in conditions that you may have a room in contents, small condition, get up into the attic spaces and start poking around as you're picking up and returning back to service. But before you leave, you certainly should be checking the attic space for any extension, but take a closer look at those construction features and identify some of the things that we're talking about. You may find full-size doors. You may find partial cubbyhole-type knee wall doors that will access into semi-occupiable spaces that have a significant amount of material and things that have been accumulated over many years that are stored in there. Or, as the UL study identifies, you may find these spaces have a significant amount of insulation that has been added that further constitutes a contributor to both the fire loading and the fire load package, and also the severity in which the fire will, again, communicate and extend. So the one important item, too, that we want to talk about here is, again, the continued importance of coordinated ventilation. And certainly, you know, many times whenever in some circles, I won't say all the time, but and you guys know this, and in some circles, whenever you talk about UL, it has such a negative connotation because, again, they're going down a certain path of changing our tradition and changing the way we do business. But certainly in the residential attic and exterior fire hazard study, in my opinion, UL did a phenomenal job of validating our understanding of the building features within this type of legacy construction and the vintage of the buildings from the 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s. Again, our typical one-and-a-half-story, two-and-a-half-story wood frame, raftered, balloon frame constructed conditions, and the importance of a coordinated vertical ventilation profiling, and again, reinforce the importance of water application. Now, I'll ask you guys this, is that, you know, they talked about a variety of different alternative measures in terms of interior stream placement, as well as the alternatives in terms of the Eve attack. What is your take? I'll start off with Joe, and then we'll turn it over to Doug. But what's your take on that application? What are some of the key learnings, both from your experience as well as the information provided by UL in their CBT, what are the couple of key takeaways that our listeners should focus in on, especially when they go back and start taking the online program, that they should be thinking about in terms of coordinated operation, ventilation, and water application?
Well, two things that struck with me was, number one, in back to knee wall fires, is that if you do have active fire in a knee wall, that the study came basically concluded that you need to attack the source fire first, and then you can aggressively open up the knee walls. And, you know, so many times you'll open up a knee wall, say we got fire, and then you'll just start attacking it as there's still active fire going on below or you know, whatever is causing that fire to get up into those knee walls. So that was one thing that they stressed: attack the base fire first, or where the fire originated from first, then aggressively open up the knee walls. The other thing was using getting up at the eaves or coming up from underneath, whether you're using an aerial device or hand lines, but to get water up into the attic from under the from either the outside or through, you know, a window up, and but instead of coming down, we always like to open up our lines down on top of the hole or that's been created by ventilation or the fire, that come up and under and attack the eaves that way or through the attic window. But those were two things that really struck me, as to consider flowing up with the master streams instead of down, and to make sure if you got an active knee wall fire, get at the source of the fire first, and then start opening up your knee walls fully.
Well, one of the things too, Joe, let me just ask you this. When we talk about exterior fire travel, especially with the cosmetic changes that have occurred on many of our buildings, we no longer have, or you may have the old asphalt impregnated sheathing and shingles that may be present, but more often than not, what do we end up finding? We find a variety of different vinyl-based coverings that have been added on to provide aesthetic and architectural treatments, to add, again, an updated appearance to the buildings. But the UL study, again, does take a look explicitly at exterior fire travel, the propagation of that fire vertically, and the impact that it has going back up into the fascia and into that soffit. So, again, you guys have really focused in tremendously about the knee wall issues and again, the rapid extension in which fire can propagate into that externally, again, from the exterior to the interior compartment. And, again, the fact that our listeners should always consider, especially our fire officers, should consider a option as one of the alternatives to the many tactical approaches, but consider that exterior sweep to at least disrupt the progressiveness of that fire extension within that area, to provide more time to identify the access path and to be able to get up into a more tenable condition within that attic space, correct?
I would definitely agree that's important. I mean, you have got to check the fire. I don't care how you check the fire. You know, the biggest thing is you have to get water into that space, exterior, interior, you know, from the, you know, walking along the, you know, the gabled ends to the open, you know, pulling down, you know, materials to be able to flow up through each, you know, rafter area. Whatever you do, you have to get water into that space. And, you know, we've seen this, and I can talk about a couple of cases that we've had that way, and Joe was going to say something, so I'm going to throw it back to Joe real quick.
Well, one of the other things that really came out of this study was that they took into consideration, again, the geometry of the rafters in legacy constructed homes and getting access to knee walls and stream application. And that sometimes, you know, based on the way the rafters are running, that you're not, you know, the basic premise of, well, we're just going to open up our stream here in this ceiling and we'll knock down this knee wall. Well, it doesn't quite, they showed in their data and their study and their experiments that the streams were being deflected by the rafters and you weren't really truly getting at the knee wall fire. And so they, again, recommend either going exterior up, you know, from the B side or D side through the eaves, or the big one that I also gained, that I also encourage the listeners to research further, is to open up around the perimeter of the rooms. So on a second floor room, to get into the knee walls, to, if you're on a B or D side, to open up around the outside first of the area closest to the outside wall in that bedroom, to open up and try to get some stream penetration that way. So that was one thing that I also gained from their study that I'd like to share with others is, you know, sometimes your angles, they did a lot of experiments with stream angles, and don't confuse that with types of streams, but the angles that you're attacking these fires. And I thought that was something that was really very impressive, because as firefighters, we don't think of those things.
And, you know, again, UL is building upon some concurrent activities that are occurring internationally. There are a number of activities occurring in the European community and the European Fire Service community that, again, are looking at and that have documented. And there's some great video clips out there. There's a couple of Facebook pages that, again, include a international composition of the fire service. And again, we have some excellent colleagues internationally that are looking at the angle of penetration within those concealed areas and compartments to determine effectiveness. So, again, the continuation of what UL is doing. The one other element here, Joe, and that we should touch upon is the fact that, you know, we're not always looking at the suppression side of that particular tactical or task element, but just also the wetting capability. So, again, for our listeners, the UL CBT and the recommendations, especially in the tactical element, discuss wetting sheathing material to primarily slow the progression and growth rate to allow, again, a more tenable condition. And, again, if we can disrupt the continuation at a rapid escalating angle of fire growth, that rate of heat release and the energy that's being given off, it gives us more of the potential to gain access, entry, and then to initiate the coordinated actions to open up the concealed compartments and initiate the appropriate suppression activities. But, again, our considerations are going to be both internal, external, and just an understanding, as you described, you know, of where these compartment spaces may be and what's the most effective, time-effective element. The key here is the effectiveness of slowing the progress of fire, because as it continues its dynamic of growth, we will end up with something that may not be achievable to suppress within a safe area of operation. So it's a combination of all of those pieces that, again, creates some dynamics in terms of our firefighting.
Well, I think we also got to throw out, too, is the size of your attic. And again, you know, we've looked at residential, you know, very closely, but let's jump over to a commercial-style building that still is of Type 5 nature, or of, as the late, great Francis Brannigan would say, the Type 6. It's got everything kind of thrown in there. And, you know, one that comes to mind to me is a church fire that we had, and it was a modern construction, large, open area of an attic that, you know, the fire actually started and then progressed up through like a vent area, a vent fan, and got into that attic space. And, you know, honestly, we had an attic space that was about 6,000 to 7,000 square feet of attic space in this large church. And one of the things you have to stop and think about, and I want you to think about this, and even in residential, is your flows. What type of flows are you putting in there to overcome the fire? And, you know, in this case, we used a blitz fire gun, and actually we're flowing 500 gallons a minute up into that attic space, you know, to try to cool that. And I think that's something that we have to look at, and that goes back to all the studies that they're talking. You know, you should be flowing about 175 gallons per minute on every nozzle now. Just no matter what you're doing, let's we've got to overcome the BTUs, because it's the types of materials that are, you know, being placed in there. You talked about the insulation, and we've talked about the wood designs. We've talked about, you know, all the stuff that could be put in there, so to speak. But, you know, we're looking at buildings being different. I know that Clemson is actually doing a study off of an AFG grant. And, you know, I'm part of that study that's coming up, and it's the cross-laminated timbers that's going into these emerging and, you know, the technologies that are going to be used that are like over in Sweden. And we're looking at these bigger buildings again, and, you know, we're going up to 7 to 10, 12, 15 stories on wood buildings. So a lot's changing, and we got to look at that. And I think we got to keep that in our mind as tacticians.
One of the things that anybody that is critical of UL or any older firefighters, when you said at the beginning, Chris, about a lot of these things, really the tactics have been the same, or are, you know, the theory has always been the same. It's just the data and the study is, when we're going back to real quick about putting water over sheathing. Well, let's think about what Bill Clark or Frank or Vinnie Dunn said about basement fires in commercials. That one tactic that may work would be flooding the floor. It's a last-ditch thing, but you're flooding the floor Well, what are you doing when they said about flooding the sheathing, getting water up on the sheathing? Well, you're doing the same thing that these gentlemen said 30, 40 years ago. It's the same theory. So none of this is new. It is excellent, excellent data. But those are the points that, so don't say, or to anybody that kind of poo-poos the study and the data, that they're old salt or what have you. Well, that's what we're looking at here. They're going back to what some of, you know, our predecessors stated in text, that we're doing the same type of tactic to try to do the same thing.
You know, we're looking at a refinement of our tactics that are proven. So, you know, time-honored, proven tactics that are being refined in terms of the manner in which we execute them. Great example, Joe, as you just described, you know, going up on the underside of the number two floor and making a penetration in the ceiling area to introduce water to into the concealed space above, you know. So, again, there are refinements that not only this study, but certainly other UL studies, NIST studies, have continued to exemplify, quantify, and validate in terms of things that we've always known. And certainly one of my advocacies is that, again, it's no longer just brute force in terms of our fire suppression activities. We really are looking at creating another layer of effectiveness in all of our fire ground operations, and certainly in this instance, when we talk about the compartment relative to the attic and within the residential setting of the legacy construction, we have obtained some great insights from UL and their Firefighter Safety Research Institute, and given us a very exceptional computer-based module that provides learnings, provides insights, and can increase the proficiencies of our company officers, as Doug talked about, in terms of our decision-making process, and give our companies a level of effectiveness to do their jobs more effectively, sometimes with limited or challenging resources, but ultimately with the same level of goals, and that is to suppress the fire, conserve the property as best as we can, and increase the life-sustaining capabilities for those civilians that may be in distress or incapacitated within that building compartment. So the job is still firefighting. We certainly, none of us, certainly in this particular show or our particular group, advocates anything but continuing with the within the rich tradition and heritage of the fire service. But we all do advocate doing it smartly with a better set of tools, and that comes through being more knowledgeable and through these types of activities. So we are coming up on our concluding segment here, which rapidly went by us, unfortunately, as we normally do. Again, another great short segment just to provide a higher level of insight and overview, and really provide some commentary to lead our listeners back to UL's Firefighter Safety Research Institute and their computer-based training module on residential attack and exterior fire hazards. So again, we have provided, you can go directly on UL's Firefighter Research Institute webpage, or we've provided a number of links and some oversights on our firegroundleadership.com webpage to provide our listeners with some direction and direct links on our Fire EMS blog site that's hosted by Penwell. So with that, any closing comments, Joe, regarding some of our discussions here tonight?
No, I think, this goes by so fast. There's so much there, but, you know, it's the little things about knowing your era of type, you know, that you protect as far as the house's age, the construction. You know, one other little thing, that these older houses, do your firefighters know that newer construction, you won't have a ridge beam, but older legacy construction, you will. That's just one example of educating and teaching your fellow firefighters the construction. And, you know, these attic fires, they're still happening. They're going to continue to happen, and it's all about thinking and getting ahead and not be tunneled.
Doug, any closing comments?
Well, I'm going to throw out, I'm going to put on my training hat since I do that most of the time in my career anymore, is looking at professional development and people's knowledge. One of the first things that we have to do as trainers, instructors, as company officers, as chief officers, is that we have to begin to take a real close look at what we're teaching. Two things have never changed in this business, and I've been in since 1979, and that's building construction and fire behavior, how the two are married together. Now, we build buildings different. We have different building materials. The construction designs are different. We have, you know, different components that go in that burn, but the fire will only behave in the building as the building construction will allow that fire to be dictated based upon the abilities of flow path, fire progression, fire travel. We spend about 1% of our entire recruit academies and firefighter training on building construction and fire behavior. We spend 0% of that typically on most of your fire officer courses because it's not even listed in 1021 of the NFPA standards. What we have got to do is to begin to study our enemy and the battlegrounds that we're on much more than what we do. So here's my challenge to all the instructors, all the officers that are out there. You should be looking at fire behavior, fire dynamics, building construction, and the two relationships and how they relate to each other on a daily basis through pre-incident surveys, through studying, through looking at all this research that's being done, and making applicable decisions prior to the fires actually occurring, knowing what you can and what you can't do and what's going to work. If you're not doing that, we're behind the eight ball, and that can, you know, truly concerns me. And especially being an advocate for Everyone Goes Home for the National Firefighters Foundation, the Fallen Firefighters Foundation. I think that's important. There's a lot of this going to be at FDIC. We're just around the corner from FDIC. This is part of what I'll talk about in my program there of taking it to the streets as far as training. You know, what are we doing for training? So continue following up on what we all are talking about and what we're, you know, on our soapboxes about tonight.
Thank you very much. Well, again, to both my colleagues, to Joe Prenesti and to Doug Klein, thank you very much for your continued friendship, brotherhood, and your contributions to the American Fire Service as we, again, close out another great program of Taking It to the Streets. And, again, I'll offer a couple of items and sort of key in on what Joe talked about and Doug. Again, the importance on recognizing what our tactical capabilities and options are. Always maintain a fluidness to those capabilities that you may have and to those options that present themselves based upon the unique circumstances of the building, the fire, and at the time in which you arrive and have to go in service for that operations. And I'll key off of an element that Doug talked about in terms of three key elements here, guys, is that's the building, the compartment, and the company, the capabilities and the limitations and the understanding of all three of those elements. So, again, we must always have the fortitude and the courage to be both safety conscious and measured in the performance of our sworn duties while maintaining the appropriate balance of risk and bravery. The demands and requirements of the modern firefighting service will continue to require the placement of personnel within situations and buildings that carry risks, uncertainty, and inherent danger. We must need and do those smartly. So, again, until next time the companies are in quarters and are off the air, stay safe, but keep in mind there's a job being worked somewhere in the streets, in your city, across the country and around the world, doing what we do best and being who we are, and that is firefighters. So take care, everyone. Until next time, John, take it away. We'll do our closing, and we'll see you next time on this edition of Taking It to the Streets.